Hey everybody, we're just doing this little quick video before the actual show starts here because the release date of this book, Take a Sad Song, has been changed. And we talked a lot about the re actual release date during this interview, but I don't want people to be confused because I think we would say that it was coming out mid-May, but now the release date has actually changed to June 1st. And again, that's the book is called Take a Sad Song. The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude by James Campion. So that's available now on Amazon. You can go there and pre-order the book if you want to. But we just wanted to do this quick little video saying that the announcement or the release date, sorry, has changed to June 1st.
Yeah, it was originally May 15th, but now it's June 1st.
Something like
So,
that, right? Yeah. So we don't want to confuse anybody here. So, but that's it. So. On to the show. Hey, McCartney fans, welcome to episode 166 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. As you know, we are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney, but today is a special day and we're going to go in the time machine. We're going to be the backward travelers, right, Andy? We're going to go back
That's
to
right.
1968 when this, when McCartney is arguably the hottest musician on the planet. And this is going to be a great time. And as you can see, we have a special guest. But first, I'm Tom Hunyadi. You know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast for myself and my three co-hosts, talk all things solo Beatles. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, a backwards traveler. He's Andy Nichols. Andy, my friend, what's going
Good
on?
evening. Good evening, Thomas. Hanging in there. And we're gonna this is interesting because we're tackling just one song, and we haven't done that too much on our show. And this
Well,
is the
we've done
first
it a
time we're
couple
doing,
times. Right.
but this is the first Beatles song we're doing, right?
Right. Exactly. And it's because, I was thinking about this earlier, and it's easier for us to tackle like one song and like a podcast like this. You know,
But I don't think
but in a
we tackled
book,
any individual songs since I've been
well, we
on.
tackled
Well,
no,
what do we
well, yeah,
do?
we have. We talked Live and Let Die, we talked Wonderful Christmas Time, right? So we talked to, we've
Couple.
done a few shows about individual songs, but here is a song that, there's not too many songs out there that can demand, a 300 page, 400 page
Yeah,
book.
I'll
You know what I
say.
mean? Not too many out there, but I think this one might be the exception to the rule. But and we're here with the gentleman who took this challenge, and I don't know if it was a challenge. We're going to find out about the making of this book, but he's James Campion, and he's a freelance journalist who he has written 8 books now, including Shout It Out Loud, The Story of Kiss's Destroyer, and The Making of an American Icon, and Accidentally Like a Martyr, The Tortured Art of Warren
Warren
Zevon.
Zevon, that's a great
Yes, this
song.
yes, Mr. Campion, welcome to the show. How are you doing, my friend?
Andy, Tom, thank you so much for having me on. And I really appreciate it. I truly do.
Yeah, not a problem. I don't know your experience with Hey Jude. I know mine, and discovering the Beatles at 13 in the mid 80s, and discovering Hey Jude, and really just I remember myself, getting as preparing for the show. I remember my 14-year-old self, with my Walkman and my cassette, and listening to Hey Jude over and over and over again, and feeling like, that they're talking to me, and helping me through, different, times in my life. And James, talk about your experience with Hey Jude, and was it important, and why is it important enough to you to write this book?
Well, it's really twofold for me. I'll answer the first part about the personal. I'm much older than you guys. I was 6 or 7, I think 6, when Hey Jude came out. Actually, I would have been six in September of 68, but I was very young. And I do remember singing myself to sleep with the na, 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 na. And it kind of stuck in my head. And I've always loved the song because of that. As you mentioned, very comforting. And as I grew older and read about the Beatles and learned about their whole canon in the 70s and in the 80s, as you guys did, that song always seemed to emerge as one of my favorites, the one I wanted to hear. And in 89, when I saw Paul McCartney play the Flowers of the Dirt Show in Madison Square Garden, I write about it in the book. What a moment. That was the moment I realized, holy crap, I'm in the same room as a Beatle when everybody is singing that song. It's quite arresting. And so that was that part. And there's other aspects too. But the other thing that kind of led me to it was I found out so many cool facts when I started to look into Hey Jude about it. In, you know, the Beatles have so many great stories about their periods and about their the individual members and the songs and the albums, certainly. But this song had so many more than all the other ones that I had seen. So that was it. And then, you know, I was inspired by a lot of my heroes, Grail Marcus, who I got to know working on this book, who wrote a book about Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. You know, Dave Marsh, who's also, I'm a big fan of his work. He wrote a book about Louie Louie. And I started to look into all of these books written about a single song. And I thought, yeah, you used the right word. I'm going to challenge myself to do that. And coupled with those three things, the personal, the real interesting aspect of the song after I did some research, and the idea that, yeah, I think it's worthy of a full book. And I can't believe it. It was. After it was over, it was. Yeah.
The the subtext of the book, the emotional currency, that's a great way to describe it.
Thank you. Yeah, take a sad song, which seemed like an easy one.
Take a sad song.
Right. And, but then I thought, it has to have something. What is it about this song? And, you know, without getting cute, it really does have an emotional currency. It had an emotional currency in one of the most difficult years in American, latter American history, 1968, which, by the way, when I was working on this book during the during the pandemic, they kept bringing up 1968 with all the street, you know, protests and riots. And of course, what happened at the Capitol at the end of the year and all these different things were happening in 2020. And I was writing this book and it kept pushing us back to six. And I'm reading, of course, about 68. I dedicate a whole chapter to everything that was going on in America and in the world. And here comes this song in August of that year and how hugely popular it is. Why would it be? And that's why I set off. And that's why I say that it does have an emotional currency in the sense where at that time, it really paid off for people then and how much the Beatles meant to people and how their songs continue to move along through the decades to keep moving people and inspiring people. So, yeah, thanks for noticing that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So the book is called Take a Sad Song, the emotional currency of Hey Jude. Now, I mean, let's start at the beginning. I mean, you mentioned COVID. I would imagine this was your COVID project, like so many people during, you know, the last 2 years, they've had a project or two and they call it their COVID project. So I guess that this would be your, you know, COVID project.
Yeah, I came up with it. I came up with the idea in mid 2019. And as these things go, they're slow to move. And at first, my publisher kind of was dragging their feet. Then I found later on that my immediate publisher, Backbeat Books, was moving to a larger concern, Roman and Littlefield, who are my publishers now. And so they weren't really at that time buying new ideas, but they kept in communication with me. And then towards the end of the year, my father got sick and passed, which was also an emotional connection. Thank you, guys. I only bring it up in the sense where it really was part of the whole weird, mystical aspect of the song and my choosing it. So I kind of got distracted and other things were happening. I was helping my mom move and all these things. And they were contacting me, said, we like the idea. But I said, I can't do it. And then, of course, a few months later, the whole world shut down.
Right.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to work on this. And my publisher at that time was like, well, everybody went home. No one's here. you can do it. But and I want to thank John Cirillo, who is one of the great he's been working with me through my books, my three books, the two you mentioned and this one with Backbeat Books. And he always answered my emails. He rooted me on. I kept him abreast of the whole situation. I told him what my idea was. And we were able to move forward. I did want to say one more anecdote about my dad passing, and I dedicate the book to him.
Right.
Hey Jude was ironically, and this was not planned, the last song I heard before he passed. And
oh,
wow.
And it, yeah. And it could, because he had been sick and I visited him in North Carolina when I was there a whole week. And you know how those things go, right? He's going to make it. He's not going to make it. So when I got back to New Jersey, my brother called and said, you know, we might have to, you know, come to grips with this. And I just couldn't get back on a plane. I was so emotionally exhausted,
right?
To use that term again, that we ended up doing the whole thing like you and I, like the three of us are doing right now. And so when I was waiting for it, my song, I was listening to music and just trying to process this, and Hey Jude popped in, and the second it faded, my brother called, and then we said goodbye to my dad. So
wow, what a story. Was he a fan? Your dad?
You know what's interesting about me and my parents? I don't know where you guys are. Gen X's, I guess you would consider yourselves.
I am.
Andy.
Yep.
Where do you fall?
I don't know. My father.
You're
was
right
the first...
at that borderline.
I'm at that
You're
borderline. Right at that borderline. My father saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, so I don't know.
There you go. Okay, so I'm the same way, but another generation. I'm not quite boomer. I was born in late '62, so they say technically it's like you're boomer. But I wasn't at Woodstock. I had no chance of going to Vietnam. You know, I didn't march on the cap. So you know, but I'm not Gen X. You know, I didn't grow up on MTV and all that, you know, Nirvana. So there's this weird quasi. So my parents kind of fell in that category. My dad was Bob Dylan's age. But, you know, my dad and Bob Dylan couldn't have been further on the spectrum of culture or politics or any of those things. But my dad loved all kinds of music. He really did. He was very open. I give my parents a lot of credit. I'm sure as your parents do, because you guys seem very passionate. They were very open to any music I brought home, no matter what it was. And no matter, you know, if it pushed the boundaries. And, you know, I give my parents all the credit in the world. They allowed me to listen to George Carlin and watch Laugh-In and watch All in the Family. And the 70s was a very heady time to be a parent. And a lot of this stuff is coming at us kids. So I was very, very fortunate. So as a tribute to my dad, I would say that my parents really were very open-minded in allowing me to discover the art that that would eventually inspire me and that I would eventually write about.
Cool. You know, writing a book like this, I mean, let's start off with a little bit about the making of it, and then we can get into the actual song. But when you write a book like this, do you need a certain permission? I mean, do you need, anything from MPL or Apple, or do they have to be in the loop that you're writing such a book?
Yes. To all those things.
Yes.
And I hope this is not too dark. I know I mentioned it before. It's getting darker. I'm in the sunroom.
Right.
So, but just so you know, and the sun is gone. The answer is yes. I had a couple of really good experiences with Paul McCartney's people. If you've read the book or you know about Paul's life, and you guys do because you're doing this podcast, probably the most significant thing that happened to Paul was losing his mom at 14 years old. And I really, really wanted to get a picture of Mary McCartney. And I went through his publicists and his people. And at first they were like, no. And then I explained to them what I was doing, what the song meant to me, all the things I'm telling you guys. And they couldn't have been nicer. And they said, okay. And I'm assuming this got to Paul, but eventually they did say no, because it means so much to him. And there's so few pictures of her. And, but it was a very nice way of being rejected. I did never feel like any pressure. As far as Apple was concerned, they were very good with negotiating. We quote in the book from Hey Jude and Revolution, the B-side. And I paraphrase a lot of other Beatles songs that I try to use as a lineage for Hey Jude. But they were very good. And I guess the real thing for me is finding my original idea for the book was to find professors of different disciplines, musicology, sociology, philosophy, psychology, and then all the Beatle biographers, Beatle experts. And it was great getting Michael Lindsay Hogg, who directed the video, and then songwriters from different generations. So for me, the grand idea and the real jazz of writing the book was getting these people on record asking them, why is this song important? Why was it number one for 9 weeks more than any other Beatles song in America? Why was it the number one international hit for the Beatles? Why do we still love it today? Paul plays it today and everyone sings. I talk about in the book, him playing at the Kremlin, everybody singing, at the White House, everybody singing, at at the big events, everybody singing. And so they all gave me some great stuff, and I was so glad. That to me was the real cool part of writing the book. But yes, to answer your question, Apple was very accommodating, and so is the Paul McCartney people.
And I would imagine having a publisher makes things a lot easier too, getting people such as Michael Lindsay Hogg, as opposed to, you know, self-publishing, which is a lot of people are doing these days.
Yes, I'm very, very fortunate. Backbeat Books, in both cases, when Backbeat Books was owned by Hal Leonard Incorporated, they were the number one, and still are, the number one music publishers. So 9 times out of 10, if you have a music book with, you know, the music for any record or anybody that you want to play on piano or guitar or oboe, it's coming from Hal Leonard. So they were great to be a parent company. Roman and Littlefield is great too. They have a wide swath of music and art books. And so, yeah, I find though, mainly guys, if you're published, when you do make that phone call, when you do make that inroads, I'm working on a new project now.
Okay.
It's a better chance to get someone on the phone. That's really, at the beginning when you start out, it's really hard to get these projects started. But I really do believe it's all about discipline, following up, and having your stuff together when you go to pitch an idea or you go to get someone to interview. But yes, having a publisher absolutely positively helps on many levels. Getting photograph rights, getting lyric rights, all that stuff. Yes.
Would you have done this project if you self-published?
No.
Okay. Fair enough.
I wouldn't, you know, it's funny because, go ahead. What are you going to say?
No, I'm just saying because we get a lot of authors that do self-publish and we hear, you know, all the trials and tribulations that go in, you know, with that. And it is a lot of work.
Yeah. I don't know how they do it. I mean, I have done self-published work, but in copyright sense, right? So I wouldn't even deign to stand up and discuss things with Apple unless I had, you know, a publisher behind me. So the short answer would be no. It's really tough lifting to do these kind of books. And, you know, I don't make it easy. When I did the Warren Zevon book, I think I quote from somewhere between 30 and 45 lyrics in there. And luckily, Jordan Zevon, his son, who's ahead of his estate, granted me a lot of those lyrics, but I had to go to Bruce Springsteen and Jackson Brown and all these different people who wrote with Warren to get the lyrics. And so that was heavy lifting on my own, because a lot of times a publisher will be like, we'll buy this manuscript, but you better make sure all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed, that you're not pushing any envelopes, because publishers can be and should be very careful about what is in a book. And to be quite frank with you, you know, it scares the hell out of me now more than anything else, because I used to do research before I authored. And it's having great copy editors and great editors, which they do to make sure that I'm on the straight and narrow, to make sure the book that you get has the information that's right. Yeah.
Let's talk about, you know, we talked about getting, you know, being published and having that help with a publisher, getting interviews, and you're talking about all these professors and writers you're talking to. Let's talk a little bit about that, because, you know, the song in itself, is just so phenomenal. I mean, so phenomenal in so many ways. I mean, musically wise, philosophically wise, you know, culture wise. I mean, just to bringing everybody together. I mean, was that always your intention to bring these people in and to talk about the book?
Yeah, that was the original pitch. I didn't want to just say, hey, this is why I love this song. First of all, I'm not qualified to do that. We're all qualified to love songs and to explain why we love them. I don't mean that. What I do mean is that one of the things that I wanted to do is, and I think you could apply almost everything I wrote in this book to any song. I'm sure, Tom, you have your favorite Beatles song or favorite Paul song or a favorite song, period. Same with you, Andy. Right. Same with your listeners. You could apply everything. I think I tried to make it where you could apply everything that I put in this book to any song. Like, why does a song work? And so when a musicologist tells you, this is why Paul did what he did, this is why this is not only works in Hey Jude, it works in a Drifter song, it works in a Adele song, it works in a Metallica song. I mean, there are only so many notes And there are so many melodies you can have. And of course, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, is Paul McCartney at finding those melodies and making them legendary. But you could apply a lot of the things that the professors added to this and songwriters. I was so jazzed to talk to so many songwriters, some of them friends of mine from different generations and different genders, to just say, hey, I tried to write a song like this. I think you need to be A, B, or C to write a song like this. I think you need to have experienced this. You have to have this kind of empathy. You have to have this kind of understanding about the human element and the human condition. So I went after this as a labor of love, in a sense where I just wanted to find out why songs work. And everybody from a different discipline has a different idea of that, right? So right. A sociologist will tell you about the zeitgeist, about the year 68, about youth, and about how the boomers absorbed music. How I loved when I talked to the psychiatrist, and her name escapes me now, and she was telling me about how we listen to music as humans naturally. We're supposed to hear music live. The brain is still not even developed enough to understand when we listen to something over and over again, that our brains tend to predict when a chorus is going to come or when a key change comes. It affects our emotions from minor key to major key. And and through studying and talking to people like Walter Everett, musicologist who worked at Beatles, and Tim Riley, these guys were able to take me into the way that Paul and John knew what they were doing to create these songs that continue to move us and could move us from the very beginning. Because in the grand argument of Beatles Stones, I'm a Stones guy. Sorry to tell you guys.
Oh no!
Wow!
But nobody. And I'm a Stones guy. And I probably like Prince more than I like the Beatles. But I could tell you right now, nobody has so many songs that we keep singing I think Adam Duritz, my friend from Counting Crows, says in the book, it's Beatles songs like scars, man. It's over. They're in there, and that's the end of
They're
it.
They're in
and
there.
That is so true. Yeah. So I just wanted to get to the bottom of that, and I got it from so many angles. And that's what I think people will enjoy this book, because you could apply the songs that you love to how these people are explaining to you from their disciplines.
Right. Now let's go into the research a little bit, because another important aspect of the song too is the origin. You know, why did Paul write this song? I mean, we know that he went to go visit Cynthia and Julian in June of 68, and kind of, you know, writing the song on the way there. Lead us into the research and your, you know, where you started. And was that something you were looking to? Were you trying to bust any myths or anything like that, or were you just going for a straightforward story?
That's a great question, Tom. I wasn't at first, but I have to say, and I'm glad you're asking this. I was hoping to get more into Paul in this podcast, because I know it's a Paul podcast, and I'm going to be doing a ton of media, and I'm just trying to find things that will be specific, maybe for your audience. So I was really excited to talk to you guys because I learned so much interviewing a lot of Paul's biographers and Beatle biographers about Paul McCartney, the boy, the musician, the man, the son, the collaborator, the superstar, the band member, the father, the lover, the husband. All of those things are poured into Hey Jude. And by the way, Paul poured into a lot of Paul's songs. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I find, and I know it's been mentioned in Beatle books before, but not to this extent, and I hope that I hit a few of these bells. I really truly believe, and I said it before, that Paul's mother passing when he was 14, and not only because he lost his mom, which is traumatic for any of us,
right?
But he lost her at 14. But from all accounts, she was an incredible woman. Very, very ahead of her time. She was the main earner for the household. And now this is in the 1950s, okay?
Right,
she was a nurse, but practically a doctor. She would run, you know, she could diagnose and help people on the spot. She by all accounts, she had a great bedside manner, loving, affectionate, very smart, made sure that the two McCartney boys spoke correctly, acted correctly. What a what a paragon of womanhood this woman to lose mm-hmm. her at that effort. And then John Lennon, who loses his mom, who is such a free spirit, such a wonderful free spirit, could not handle him and was young and promiscuous and flighty the way John was. And for him to lose her in that violent, violent way a couple of years into Paul and John's relationship, and their very first songs, you know, I've Lost My Little Girl, songs mm-hmm. like that, mm. what are they saying in a way? And when Paul says in his 40s, when I was 23, 24 years old and I wrote Yesterday, I think I wrote it about my mom. Because mm-hmm. why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. Back then, in the 50s, if someone in the family got sick, and especially for Mary McCartney, because she was in the medical profession, she did not want to bother doctors what she was feeling. And because we know more now about breast cancer, back right. then...
She didn't even tell her the kids, really. No.
1 minute, she's home. The next right. minute, she's dying in a bed.
Right.
Different. And that's traumatic right. if you're 35 years old, but 14?
Especially in the 50s.
Right. And so I really do believe that John and Paul's best love songs, especially in the early days, even something like I Want to Hold You, She Loves You, which a lot right. of the Beatle writers say that the lineage between She Loves You and Hey Jude is very, very, very strong. Where here you got a man talking to another man, like Paul is talking to Jude, and mm-hmm. telling him about a woman. In She Loves You, it's like, hey, go get her. She loves you. That's a good thing. And in Hey Jude, it's like, you got to let yourself open your heart. You know, go out and get her. She's right there. I mean, when I discovered that in the book and what it meant to Paul and what it meant to John, the Beatles songs bloomed for me. I saw, and when John says in 1980, in one of his last interviews for Playboy, he says, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, that was the magic girl I was looking for after my mom died, and I found it in Yoko. And the fact that when John wrote Julia, very close, by the way, to the time period when Paul wrote Hey Jude,
mm-hmm.
he wrote it about his mom, Julia.
Right.
He uses the term ocean child. Mm-hmm. And ocean child is Yoko Ono.
Yep.
In Japanese. So
yep.
it's just, and I think it was Tim Riley who told me, John was always very aware that Yoko was, in a very real way, a salve, S-A-L-V-E, for the pain of his mother, the loss of his mother, this thing he was always searching for. Paul wasn't as aware of that, but because Paul had a deeper empathy for women, like Lady Madonna or Your Mother Should Know, songs like that, that he was always, and the fact, guys, that these two men, who were the best of friends and the most incredible collaborators, would meet the women that would complete them within about, I don't know, 4 months of each other, and then marry those
couple
women
months apart.
Within about 7 days of each other,
right.
is just way more than coincidental, man. And I just think that Hey Jude encompasses the fact that John heard Hey Jude and told Paul, and this is not something John would do. In fact, John used to make fun of, he wrote songs about Beatle fans, you know, overanalyzing things, like, you know, like what's the Glass Onion.
Right.
So for John to say, Paul, this song's about me. I found her. Go and get her. I found Yoko. And Paul is kind of saying, okay, but I think it's kind of me because I found Linda, even though I wrote this song for your son, which you mentioned earlier. So it's all in this stew, man. It's all in the stew. Yeah.
It is. And I always felt the sense that, you know, that the Paul, I mean, he's had this experience of losing a parent, just like John, but he's able to, you know, transform it into more of a positive light, I think, than John was able to do at that point in time in his life. Maybe just because Paul had a little bit better of an upbringing. You know, he's able to, you know, comfort a child, and maybe he wanted to be a father as well. And, you know, and to go out there and to do this for you know, the kid he's known all his life for the most part, right? I mean, he's known Julian all his life.
Cynthia.
So, yeah, and Cynthia. Yeah, right.
And Paul's love of children, he was very close to his father's step, you know, his stepsister. He was close to Linda's first daughter.
First daughter, yep.
And he was And he loved Julian. And he would play with Julian. And there's one anecdote that Paul mentions that I put in my book where he's playing with Julian and John pulls him aside and says, "How do you do that? How and later Paul says, "You know, I think it's because, you know, I had a very," and this goes back to the point, and I did include a picture of Paul's dad, James, in the book. After Mary dies, I mean, James is devastated. And they're in dire straits financially because she was the breadwinner.
The breadwinner, right. Yep.
And he would play the piano to soothe himself. And Paul says, you know, that is very much that kind of, if I use that word lineage again, here's his father going crushed and not hiding it and getting to the piano. And Paul, you know, sees that in the fact that Hey Jude is a piano song. And of course, so is Let It Be in some of the song and Lady Madonna songs that you know, in Let It Be, he evokes his mother, Mary.
Right.
That these very important emotions are connected. So, yes. And I think that that's something that John didn't have. His father left him very young. He was very bitter about it. Never really accepted him when his father came out of the woodwork when he became famous. And so that is a huge difference between the two of them. Yes. And in John's woman songs early in life, there's this fear. Hope right. she doesn't leave. Oh no. I hope, you know, I what have I right. done? I've got to fix this. Whereas Paul's like, you know, I hope we can work this out or something. That even when he's being bitchy to in his songs, like For No One or We Can Work It Out, he is kind of with Jane Asher. Paul right. is still trying to figure it out, where John is like, holy crap, I can't figure this out. I'm going to lose her. Why? It's really, it does add another, for me, it added another depth to the Paul and right. John relationship and their songwriting.
Well said. You were also fortunate enough, like you said earlier, to talk to Michael Lindsay Hogg and talk about that experience and what you learned from him.
Well, Michael, first of all, is a brilliant, brilliant mind and a great guy. And he couldn't have been nicer. He sent me his memoir. We talked. He was very elusive when we were, you know, as the months were going on, everybody's talking about the Peter Jackson stuff. He knew exactly, right, exactly. what the hell was going right. on. But he did give me some great insight into that. But mainly, you know, if no one knows, Michael Lindsay Hogg made himself famous on British yep. television doing comedies. He worked with David Frost and other producers. So mostly he did fiction stuff on TV, but he got connected into the pop world by doing these shorts. Yep. At the time in the 60s, in the case of the Beatles, they stopped touring in 66. So they had to have some way to get out some material of showing them play. So Michael Lindsay Hogg ended up doing, I think, Paperback Writer and Rain. Clips.
Yep.
He ended yep. up doing the Jumping Jack Flash for the yep. Stones when they couldn't tour because of Brian Jones's, you know, drug issues. You know, they couldn't get visas to go to America. He worked with The Who. So he became very, you know, he was very sought after. So the fact that Paul would go after him for the Hey Jude thing makes perfect sense. And he was great in a sense where he kept telling me everything, every step of the way. And that's probably my favorite chapter in the book is that video is just so indicative, so yep. illustrative of what the Beatles meant to that generation and what that song did to encapsulate it. I mean, the fact that when he says to Paul, he says to Paul, "We can't have you singing Na 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 for 4.5 minutes. Nobody wants to see that. I know you're the Beatles, but so Paul's like, "What do you want to do?" He goes, "What if we get the world to sing it?" And just on that one line, he draws Paul in. He goes, "Oh, you mean like the postman?" And he goes, "Yes." And so that's what they did. They went out and got people of different races, different genders, different
yep.
ages, different religions and creeds. And they put them in this room and the Beatles. Yeah, and the fact that he told me every time the Beatles would break, they would play songs, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, you know. And they would do a live version of Hey Jude, and they would play off the crowd because they said they kept bringing in a different crowd. If you haven't seen this video, everybody, go watch it now and then come back to listen to us talk about it. But and then they would do another take, and they'd bring a new crowd in. So the Beatles got, you know, re-inspired each time a new crowd came in. And I thought it was great that Peter Jackson in that 4 or 5 minute opening to Get Back, that he gives the proper – He gives the props to Hey Jude.
Yep.
because after Hey Jude,
it's a Twickenham,
right? And,
which is also a Twickenham, yeah,
right. And he and Paul says, "I want to do this. I wanted." It wasn't just that though. You guys probably know this, and I put it in my book. I discovered it when I was working on the book. A TV crew came in and shot the Beatles rehearsing Hey Jude. Mm. So the footage you see on YouTube now is from a TV show, and again, the name escapes me, but on the BBC, in which they were trying to find
David Frost, wasn't it? David Frost.
Well, Frost is the guy who did the Hey Jude clip. But if you go on to YouTube, you could see the Beatles in a in Abbey Road before they go to Trident Studios.
Oh, before they're
rehearsing.
Right. Okay.
And you notice that George is not there because George is trying to put those licks in, and Paul doesn't want him. So that's a whole thing going on there. But it's great because you see them kind of working it out and laughing and joking with each other. And in essence, that's what Get Back was supposed to be. But then it obviously devolved and the band was in a bad place at the time. And then Twickenham was cold and they had to get there early in the morning. And it wasn't really indicative to working together. But that Hey Jude shoot and writing Hey Jude and having the TV cameras in there to show the Beatles creating was the impetus for Let It Be. And then eventually this brilliant, I don't know what you guys thought, Jackson thing that he did.
Oh yeah, no, it was excellent.
Loved
it. Yeah,
we loved it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you see, and you see in those. And by the way, sorry, Tom. You see what I'm talking about in my book. When I was watching that thing, because of course I sent the, you know, I finished it. My deadline was April, so it came out. When did it come out? I remember November, I think.
Yeah, Thanksgiving.
So my book was already in the stages of getting, you know, rights and photos, and the cover was being designed. So it was too late to really comment on it in the book. But I was so buoyed by the fact that the Paul-John relationship in that film is the one that I learned about writing about Hey Jude. It was all came alive. Just the way Paul saw the band, the way John saw Paul, the way Paul and John saw George. The way Ringo is just Ringo, man. He is just the freaking coolest. You know, he's always there ready to play. And when he plays, it's perfect, which is
magic.
He is on Hey Jude. So,
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The you know, Michael Lindsay-Hogg, I mean, that suggestion, you know, the world. When you have a song that special, you need a special visual. And that visual of just everybody coming in, it's just as emotional as the song. Yes. Really, I mean, for one glimpse moment, you feel like a song can solve all your problems.
So, you know, well said.
For seven minutes and 14 seconds,
right.
Yes, and thank you. I Andy is almost quoting my book there verbatim. At the end of that chapter, I basically say, the world is coming apart. You have two horrible assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. You have riots on campuses. You have African Americans being shot in the streets in the South. You have students, you know, burning draft cards. You have dozens and dozens of kids coming home dead every day from Vietnam. In France, they riot in the streets so badly in France that De Gaulle has to leave the country, and they shut the economy down. You think things were bad in 2020? They basically said there's no more money. You got Ireland and England. You've got protests in the streets. You got the Mexico City Olympics where they're shooting people. The police are killing people that are making any kind of noise outside the Olympic Village. It's what a year.
No, and I know a lot of people like to just say that the 1968 in terms of America was pretty kind of the unrest was big. But I mean, you just kind of showcased how worldwide it was still a big problem.
Right. So when they debut that film, that video on the Smothers Brothers show, in late 1968, or the fall of 68. And it had already run in England and other places, certainly. But when it came here, it was like right around the Democratic convention where, need I say more, the whole world is watching. You police are beating children up, you know, to a pulp, and people are throwing bricks at, you know, it's just, and and I'm not saying a song can fix that. And I know a lot of people blow back and say, it's a trite song. And so is Revolution, because John's like, I want to be part of it. No, I don't. You people are just running around.
But it was John. 1 minute he was that, and then the next minute he flip-flopped. That's what he did.
Right. But for the Beatles, you can't and I know you guys wouldn't, but you can't underestimate what the Beatles meant to that generation and to the world. And for few minutes, and as you mentioned, Andy, 7 minutes and change, for Paul to be looking into that camera and then the Beatles together playing, which they hadn't done in a couple of years. You see them in a room playing. Oh, my God, the Beatles are back. And then all these people coming out of the woodwork, people wearing turbans, people, you know, old guys with pipes, young hippie girls, everybody singing this nonsense. Nah, doesn't even have words. It had to do something. It just had to soothe someone. It's 7 minutes of... And I think it was Kai Lotz, who goes by the name of Petal, wonderful singer-songwriter, who told me, let it out, let it in.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe. That's what that means. That's what she said. And when these songwriters tell me these things, I get the chills. And I go, I can't wait to put it in the book. Because, again, you could pick out lines from your favorite song, and you'll go, oh, yeah.
Right.
Never in a million years. I should have thought of it. Now it seems so obvious. Let it out, let it in.
And then, you know, yeah, and you talk, I mean... Number one in 18 different countries. You know, that's pretty impressive.
Amazing. Even for the Beatles. I mean, that was, you know, by 68, the Beatles had plateaued. They were no longer 60. I don't know what you guys think, but 67, you know, Sgt. Pepper's was their apex. That's when they could do no wrong. They were as close to human gods on Earth as you could possibly get. Then Brian,
you know, dies, Tour and all
Magical
that.
Mystery Tour, the Maharishi, all that stuff starts to dilute a little bit, that whole, you know, invincible four-headed monster, which I quote from Mick Jagger, you know, throughout the book.
Right.
So in 68, for them to come out with this, and I think it was either Rob Sheffield or one of the guys that I interviewed for the book who said, think about this. This is the last Beatles single. And let's... They're a singles band, right? That's how they made it. They made great singles. They made great albums, but their singles are legendary. They're massive. 20 number one hits in America, but, you know, all that stuff. This is the last time all four of those guys would make a song specifically for a single, because the Ballad of John and Yoko is just Paul and John.
Right.
And then all the other singles from Abbey Road and Let It Be are on the album. This is it.
That's a great point. I never actually even thought about that until then. And maybe Lady Madonna would be the one before that, but really, yeah, that's a cool fact. Never thought of it that way. Wow.
Let's talk. I don't know if you have a copy of the book there, but let's talk about that cover for a second, because that image of Paul there, and you know, I saw it on Amazon. I mean, we'll talk about that a little bit, but I mean, it's a painting, right? I mean,
I'm glad you mentioned that. My good friend Roberto Tatis, who designed that, will be very happy. I wish I could give, and obviously we give credit to the photograph in the book, to the gentleman who took it. So the cover was very interesting, because I did not want the Beatles to be on the cover. I didn't even want Paul to be on the cover, because, again, I wanted this to be about a song.
Right.
Excuse me. And I know it's a Beatles song, and I know Paul wrote it, but I wanted it to be a song. So my first thought was, I know a few years ago, someone bought the lyrics. I know that Julian quietly bought the studio notes for Hey Jude back in the aughts. But there's a handwritten Hey Jude in Paul's handwriting from 68 that I was going to get, which you can get on Getty Images, and then have them make that the background. Because if you look at Dave Marsh's book on Louie Louie, he's got a long subtitle. So the subtitle's all written in script, and then Louie Louie's in the front. So I had that idea. But, of course, there's legal issues to that. You could quote it, but using it as an image, it's someone's private property, that kind of thing. Okay, so that was out. Then I had purchased an original Apple single, of Hey Jude when I started the book. And I always like to do this when I write a book, is have a talisman right next to me. And so the single was always there as I was writing the book. So I said, it's my record. Let me take a photograph of that. And you guys can fix it. And no, because the Apple logo is, you know, property of Apple and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So could use that. So I was at my wit's end and I was bopping around looking for photographs for inside the book. And I love that photograph of Paul closing his eyes, I think somewhere in the, you know, last 15 years. So he's the older Paul, which is showing the emotional currency of the song for him. And he's closing his eyes, and I loved it. But I just thought, it's Paul, and I'm going to be – not that I love Paul, but I didn't want it to be, like, about Paul, you know, even though it's about other things. And so I had a t-shirt that I bought off of Etsy. Another thing I do is I always get a t-shirt of whatever I'm writing about. So I have this Young Paul t-shirt. I wish I wore it right now. I'll show you. And someone had done like a Photoshop or some, I don't know how they do it, make it look like a painting. So I gave I took a photograph of the shirt. I gave it to my friend Roberto Tatis, who is a designer. He designed other books for me, but you know, he doesn't work for Roman and Littlefield. So I said, can you at least mock it up as a painting? And he did. And they loved it. So, and it was his idea to use the fonts that are very much like the Beatle fonts from the era. And I loved it like that. So I had actually went from total despair about the cover to total joy, because I think Paul does with his eyes closed. You know, there's a great story that Paul tells, if I may. I included it in the book. And it's Bob Costas in the early 90s had him on. I love Bob. And he, mm-hmm. he asked him, do you ever think about the lyrics that you're singing and how they're affecting the audience? Of course, Paul's like, no, I'm just trying to get through these songs. I got to remember the lyrics. It's like being on stage, right. being an actor. You're trying to remember your lines and everything. And then, but he says he always connects to the emotion of the song, how he wrote it, what he felt like when he wrote it. And whenever he sings, the movement you need
right.
is on your shoulder.
Your
as
shoulder,
we all know, as
right.
Beatles fans, was John's favorite line. And John told him, you cannot change that line. Paul just kept it as a placeholder, like scrambled eggs for yesterday. And he says, I can't, as soon as I sing that line, John's here. I feel him.
Mm.
So that's what I think about when I look at the cover of my book is Paul, you know, just had sung that line. This is what I'm thinking, you know, and he's putting his head back and saying, hey, John, man, nice job. Nice job. We did a good job. So in essence, it's Paul on the cover, but the spirit of John is there too, obviously.
Right. Am I muted, Andy? Can you hear me?
Yeah,
oh, you're there. Yep.
Okay. I love that you added some of these facts, because I mean it's just crazy how successful this song was. I mean, the top single of 68, right? 6 million units sold worldwide. Number one in 18 countries, and you know, an Ivor Novello Award winner, nominated for 3 Grammys. You know, and then you count in the length of the song, which was a record up until Don McLean. You know, it's just so overwhelming in a way that if you know you got to take this all in and how successful it was, it's just really is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I know Taylor Swift had a 10-minute song a couple of months ago, which I right. just got in under the radar. But it, technically, right. though, Hey Jude is the longest running single on the A side. So obviously, and I love Taylor, but her song is digital, right? So you could have a 40-minute song.
Right.
I know Bob Dylan had like a 20-minute song last year or something.
Right.
Myrtle's Spell. Yeah. But it's not, yeah, on an A side of a single. Yeah.
Right. Hey, and right. Don McLean's, you know, American Pie. And I interview actually his daughter, Jackie McLean, is a great songwriter in her own right, who talks about her connection to that song based on her relationship with her dad in the book. But
wasn't MacArthur Park by Richard Harris just a little bit longer?
It was just number two.
Two, right.
It didn't make it to number
one. It never reached number one.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Like a Rolling Stone is close, too, right. but that was right. also number two. This is the longest running right. number one song. And
right.
I just to finish my anecdote or my factoid,
right.
the American Pie, which is what we're talking about, was when I got it as a kid, half the songs on side A, half the songs on side B. So Hey Jude, because he was working with, because, you know, the Beatles were the Beatles, they were working with George Martin and Jeff Emmerich and some of the greatest sonic
engineers.
Minds in the history
yeah.
of pop music.
Right.
They got it to sound great on one side, which is an achievement in and of itself.
Mm.
To have
right.
that grooves sound that good on a 45 for 7 minutes.
For seven is, minutes and change. Yeah.
It's insane. Right. It's and of course yeah. there were a lot of other firsts. The first Beatles song done on 8-track, recorded
yeah,
at wow. Trident Studios outside of Abbey Road. It was yeah. the first, it is still the
Apple.
It's the highest selling debut single by a label.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And you know, like you said, it's funny because I've noticed a lot of these lists change every 5-10 years, and rightfully so. There's new songs, new generation, new writers. But for the longest time, Hey Jude, at least in the list that I put in the book from the 80s and 90s, Hey Jude was always the highest ranking Beatles song.
Mm-hmm.
And that also was something I didn't know until I started this. That's what I'm saying. The song drew me in. It really tickled a lot of my journalistic, you know, amateur historian kind of vibe. And I was able to discover these things. I couldn't wait to share them with readers.
Right. I think it was stayed that way up until, was it I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, I think tied it or beat it by 1 week. And then I think, you know, Olivia Newton-John's Physical tied it for 9 weeks as well. So, I mean, there's been other successful, you know, singles as well. But this, yeah, like you said, this was, you know, the first, especially at that length, at 7 minutes plus, you know, it'd never been done before.
Oh, yeah, it was unheard of. I mean, obviously, again, Like a Rolling Stone was long, but Dylan appealed to a different audience. I mean, the fact that that cracked in, you know, but this is an AM hit. This is a pop hit by a huge pop band. And yeah, I mean, once the SoundScan era came in the 90s, you have some of these hit songs by Boys to Men and Mariah Carey that went on for 18 weeks. Which you could have made the argument that that might have been the case with Hey Jude if they didn't include back in the day before the SoundScan, it included, because I worked at a record store in the 80s and I know Billboard used to call us and say, how many, you know, bads did you sell? How many Purple Rains did you sell? You know what I mean? How many Like a Virgins? And you would give them and they would couple that with how many radio plays, like radio stations would say, okay, this song is our number one requested. We play this song this many times an hour, and then sales. So sales was kind of third or kind of lumped in with all that. And we know the Beatles, you know, you mentioned it's 6 million sold in, you know, what, 5 months. The Beatles sold. We know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You talk about the you saw him on the 89 tour. And see, Paul was very wise to include that and play it live for the first time in 89. You saw the show. Talk about the emotional currency. He was cashing in on those baby boomers' emotions by putting it in that set list at that time.
Right.
Exactly that, what he was doing.
He sure was. And for all of us, it was so great because I know in 76 when he toured the famous, you know, Wings Over America, he did like I've Just Seen a Face and Yesterday. But he didn't do, you know, Lady Madonna or Magical Mystery Tour or Sgt. Pepper's or, you know, Fool on the Hill or, you know, he was cranking them out for that tour. And he would the great band. But again, it was a different level for me for Hey Jude. What a wonderful show that was. And I'm going to see Paul in Syracuse because I'm doing a book signing. And if I may, I know this, I don't know when this is going to come out, but on my website, jamescampion.com, I will list all the bookstores I'm going to be visiting. I'm going on a book tour. So I actually doing a signing in Syracuse on June 4th. My wife's family's from there, and I'm very excited. And we're doing it that afternoon, and then that night we're going to go see Paul, who's playing there. That
excellent.
Awesome. I haven't seen him in a long time, so yeah. I mean,
you're not going to go see him here in our backyard in a few weeks.
I've never even been in that building.
Come on,
really? Never been in that building. I stopped watching NFL football years ago, so I haven't been in that building for anything. Yeah, I'm going to miss that. Although I may do my plan is to do a jersey signing either the day. I think he's playing in the middle of the week, like the day before.
Thursday.
Yeah. Like maybe a Wednesday night, do something. I'm doing a Jersey City one the week the book comes out, which is May 15th.
Oh, great.
You're just going to stick to the East Coast or are you going to come out to the West?
Well, right now, the last one I did, the Zevon book, I did, I went out to LA because he's from LA and I got to meet a lot of people that were in the book. I think I'm going as far as Chicago, perhaps. I know I want to do a Philly. I want to do Boston. Right. Here was my idea. My idea was to do events with people I talked to in the book because this is so much fun talking to you guys, but I feel like I'm kind of taking what I learned from other people and espousing it as my own. I want everybody to get the book and read what these people have to say. They're genius. They're brilliant at how they break this stuff down.
Oh yeah. And I've met quite a few of them.
Oh, great. Yeah. I would love I would love to do a Boston signing with Tim Riley. And he said he would. I want to do a Brooklyn signing with Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. I know he will.
Yep.
So that's my plan. And so if somebody from, you know, out there in the West comes through or, you know, I'm never averse, even though it's crazy with gas prices now, I'm never averse to flying around or driving around and doing events. Writing is very isolating. So when you have a chance to do events and meet people and talk to fans, it's especially when you write nonfiction. So you're writing about people, subjects that people care about. And certainly people do care about the Beatles. I think it was Rob that said to me, and I put it in the book, the Beatles didn't happen. They're always happening, you know? And that is very true. Look, the Stones still tour. Okay. I know we just lost Charlie Watts, and to me, that's the end of the Stones for me. I mean, Charlie Watts changes the whole aspect of the way Stone songs are played. Stone songs are probably covered more than any other band songs, but you, even though you see bands play Satisfaction or Honky Tonk Women or you know, Brown Sugar or Wild Horses, it never sounds like the Stones. And I think Charlie is that little sousance, that pepper. But my point is that they're still out there, but they don't have that same emotional current for me, emotional currency. And even you're right, Andy, he did cash in on that in 89. But I use the word currency always that the one term, the one phrase that everybody kept using, especially songwriters in my book, it's a song that pays off. Mm-hmm. When you first hear Hey Jude, we all know it's coming.
Right.
You know what's coming. You don't the first time, which is fascinating. You wonder what people would have thought, you know, what the hell's going on? The coda, the na-na-nas are going on longer than the actual song. What the hell is going on? But as children of the 70s and 80s and 90s and move on, we all know what's coming when Paul says, Hey Jude. And when he sings Hey Jude, I think it was Eric Hutchinson who pointed this out to me. The genius of Hey Jude is when you – and I ask you, Tom, how does Hey Jude go? What do you say? Hey Jude.
Hey Jude.
It's the name of the song. It's the melody of the song. It's the whole goddamn thing in one shot. Yeah, yeah.
But a funny story. I mean, my dad heard the song the first time in 68 on the radio, and all he heard was the refrain for the 4 minutes. And he was like – and he didn't hear the first part. So he said to his friend, he goes, I heard the new Beatles song. It's called Na 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 Na, and it sucks. And my friend said, are you nuts? Did you listen to the whole song? He's like, yeah, it was na, na, na for 4 minutes. And he goes, no, you got to hear the whole thing. So
that's brilliant. That was pretty cool. That great story, Andy. I give my love to your dad because I wish I put that in my book. That is a fantastic anecdote. Can you imagine the poor sucker, the poor guy who turns on the radio in the middle? Where the hell is the lyric? This is it?
Yeah, because the guy goes, the DJ goes, and that's the Beatles number one. That's it. And my dad's like, what? For 4 minutes? That's what it was?
Boy, the Beatles have really given up.
Yeah.
But I still love that part, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I just love
it. Yeah, a couple more things.
Sure.
Did you dig into the song? Did you listen to bootlegs? Did you listen to different to edits and stuff like that of the song?
I heard what everybody else has heard. That's on Anthology. Right. That's on YouTube. I break down all the available versions, and I tried to piece together. Thanks to Mark Lewison, who was very helpful to me, in the greatest Beatle book ever. that and Rob Sheffield's Dreaming the Beatles, which is a masterpiece. And you know, I know it was great piecing together from inspiration, you know, going to visit Julian, to composition, going home and playing on his magic piano, to working to John and Yoko hearing it and John being like, this song's about us, about me, to rehearsing, being filmed. Thank goodness we have that film because I was able to describe it in the book and break it down in the great, you know, evolution of the song. And then the recording of the song, which I don't want to give away my whole book here, but
don't.
If you know how that song is recorded, it's just so great.
Quickly it was recorded,
it's
too.
It's spiritual. There is something. I know Paul does this a lot, and I quote him in the book as saying, everything's magic with Paul, right? The songs come out of the magic. Music is a magic to us. Magic piano, magic take of a song. The Beatles and their audiences have a magic connection. But in many ways, he's kind of right. There are some things that are inexplicable in this world, and the recording of Hey Jude is one of those things.
No doubt. Good. Well said. How about yourself? Are you happy where you're at right now in your career? Because you seem to be on an artistic peak yourself right now. I mean, you're very successful with your books right now. I mean, you've got a nice, you know, a nice bibliography right now. And it just seems like you're on a creative peak yourself. I mean, are you happy with the path your career has taken?
I mean, always. You know, I'm very, very fortunate. You know, I used to kick myself that I wasn't published till I was 32. But now that I'm 59... You know, I'm very, very fortunate and very, very glad and extremely lucky and all those things to be published at all and to have readers. I work for a great, I'm associate editor for a great magazine that's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Aquarian, which I've been with since 97, my longest running job. You know, I did a podcast for 2 years with a guy I got to know very well, Adam Duritz, working on a book together. Right. You know, I got to, and on that podcast, we got to, you know, to curate the Underwater Sunshine Festival, which is, we're hoping to get it going again for this fall in New York City. I hope you guys can make it. And, you know, I get to write about music, which was my, really my first love as a kid. And so thank you for pointing that out, Tom, because there's very rarely do I get to exhale. I try to go, so a lot of times I'll overlap projects. Right. Because I feel if I'm not working on something, I don't exist. I mean, I know I'm a dad and a husband and a friend and a son and all those things and a brother. Right. But I really feel like I'm not part of
that shark's mentality. You know, you can never sleep.
Yes, yes. And what we have on our hands is a dead shark, as Woody Allen once said. No, I say if you're not working, if you're not busy being born, as Bob said, you're busy dying. But no, I am very fortunate. I feel very. I like the fact that if I have an idea, I've got people who support it and that work with me. And I really hope this book, I hope people buy the book. Obviously, I hope people enjoy it, get out of it what I put into it. And I think it's worthy of it. It's very important to me, especially after my dad passed, to express what songs do for me and do for all of us. And just using Hey Jude as that jumping off point, it feels good to get it out. You know, it's so funny when you're working on a book, you always feel like a boulder is going to fall on your head or an anvil or something. And then that's it. You feel like, I remember people would say, I read books because I'm in essence, I'm buying the time to read it. So I feel like I will never die, but I feel the opposite. I'm always in a panic that somehow I'll just keel over in the middle of a book and I won't finish it. So when I get it done and we're so close to it coming out, and then hopefully it'll be out when this comes out. I really do feel like, now people can read it and give me guff for it or a thumbs up or maybe tear up or laugh. And that's why I love doing the book signings too, because people will come up to me and say, you know, I cried when I read this part, or that happened to me, or yes, I got that out of this song, or do you like this song? Because this song does this for me. And I love that so much.
Right. The book again is called Take a Sad Song, The Emotional Currency of Hey Jude. Where can people, I mean, I've already pre-ordered it. Where do you want people? I mean, send people where they can pre-order the book.
Yeah. As they say, it's wherever good books are sold. I always, even though I'm just as guilty as anybody else, I order a lot of books on Amazon. I always support, and I try to do book tours. I for my Warren Zevon one, I think I did 10 bookstores and 9 of them were all independent. And the only reason I did a Barnes & Noble, which I love Barnes & Noble, I'm nothing against that. I did it because the bookstore that we had booked wasn't there, or they went under. Something happened with it. So we ended up, we didn't want to disappoint everybody up in Syracuse. So that's why I'm doing the same Barnes & Noble when Paul's there this time. But you could get it anywhere. Pre-order it. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, you know, wherever.
James, can you give us a list of your signings, and then we can include that when we post it?
Thank you. Yes, I will. We're still putting them together now when you guys know when this will be out. And then I always plug this. It's true. If you want to know where everything is, where we're going to be or anything, we have a Facebook page now for Hey Jude, the Hey Jude book Facebook page. I put content up there, Hey Jude covers. It's a great, you know, little community. And on my website, if you order the book through my website, I will sign the book. And as long as you live in the contiguous or the continental United States, I will send it to you for free. So you buy the book and you get free shipping and I will sign it. I will sign it to whomever you want. If you want to give it as a gift to a friend or a relative. And that's everywhere you can find the book. And I'll keep everybody apprised of my doings on my Twitter account, which is
excellent.
Fear
Noir. Yep. We follow you. We follow you on Twitter as well. So we'll make sure we keep an eye out. What's that?
Same here. I follow you guys. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. I really enjoy the
much.
Show. I really enjoy the show. The great thing about this is I'm able to discover new podcasts. And ever since I was podcasting, I enjoy so many of them. And of course, when I was working on the book, it was buoyed by the fact that you guys were doing something on McCartney and you know, the other guys were doing stuff on the Beatle ones. And I'm really looking forward to doing other podcasts and talking about different angles of the song and at different parts of the career. So, and I love the fact that you settle on Paul's solo career because it's so underrated. Do you guys have a favorite?
It is.
You have a favorite?
Oh, like song or album or whatnot, or I mean, it's just it's just so many. I mean, it's just so many.
Too many.
You know, I
tell you what, James. I'm gonna put you on the spot. I want to put you on the spot. What's your favorite Warren Zevon song?
Desperados Under the Eaves.
Oh, good one.
First Asylum album. It was the first essay I wrote for my book, and I sent it to my editor at the time, Bernadette Malavacca, who I miss. She went on to another publisher, but she was like, "Ooh, do another one." You know, that kind of thing. And it became a book, which was really neat. I did want to say, okay, so you don't really have, see, I have my.
Ram for me is my favorite album.
Red Rose Speedway.
Second album. His second album is mine.
Red Rose Speedway. Right. Gutsy. I love. All right. So here's my top five Beatles solo albums for you. Ready?
Okay.
Go. Yeah.
I do have a top five.
Oh, great.
Plastic Ono Band, which I think is maybe arguably the greatest solo album of all time because it does everything a solo should. You're talking about your band, your life, your past, your present. I mean, he just completely lays his guts out. I mean, it's a hard album to listen to, and you can't play it a lot. But when you do listen to it, you're floored. You need 5 minutes.
Yep.
Ram is number two, my favorite Paul McCartney album. I think I am so glad that that's got Re and Tom, that came back. Yep. Because when I fell in love with that record in the late 70s, early 80s, I could not believe the utter bashing of it. I mean, everybody thought that was not only bad. I was listening to this, and what am I missing? What am I missing? How is this bad? I can understand you not liking it or loving it. It's not as good as the Beatles, although I will argue it's.
Oh no, it's in the ballpark.
Backseat of my car. You know, come on, Admiral Halsey.
Yes,
but my point is, it's not there. But I'm saying I understand for people with the Beatles. Okay, I can't give Paul 100%, but you're telling me that album sucks? Everybody said that album sucked. How is that even? So the fact that people are drooling over it now, fantastic. Ram, Band on the Run, which is kind of accepted as his finest work. I put it as number two. I love it as well. It was the first Paul McCartney I actually listened to. I had the 45 when I was a kid. So it's kind of my introduction into Paul post-Beatles. Because I remember when it first came out, Hell on Wheels, the whole nine yards. I would put number four, you guys are gonna kill me. The third Ringo album, Ringo.
No,
why?
Worthy.
I mean, no one would fault you for that.
If you said You're, Ringo fourth or something, maybe. But
yeah, right. If you would have said like Sentimental Journey or you know,
but then maybe it's a Beatle album.
It's a freaking Beatle album. You know, everybody's on it.
The band.
Everybody's on there. I mean,
Randy Newman song.
Yes.
Fantastic. Yeah. And number five. Imagine.
Oh wow! So no George, huh? Your top five.
I'm not a big fan of George's solo work. I. You know what
I do?
So
no George book in your future then.
I will. Yeah. You know it's funny when I did the Warren Zevon book. Everybody asked me, why Warren Zevon? Every time, like the first thing out of their mouths. And I say,
why not? And you should have said, why not?
Thank you, Andy. But I didn't. I said, because there's enough Beatle books.
Right. Thank you very much.
And so what did I do? I wrote another goddamn Beatle book. No, but that's why I was trying to stay away from the Beatles. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, is it an overanalyzed, and I make a joke about it in my book. Because I have one of the chapters is a very brief history of the Beatles because I wanted people to know, look, if you don't know, you might not know the minutiae of the Beatles.
There's
like
always going to be beginners out there. Always going to be beginners out there. And Peter Jackson had that in mind when he did that little 10-minute snippet of
opening,
you know, before Get Back.
And everybody complained about it, but I totally got it. And it's funny because Kurt Vonnegut always wrote for his sister. And I always write for my wife. Because my wife doesn't care about anything I like. Like that's not entirely true, but not to the extent that I do. You know what I mean? And I mean, nobody does. You guys are lunatics. You're doing a podcast, so you kind of get it. But so I always say I have to convince my wife that Hey Jude is a great song and it did all these things and it was that moving and it really reflected Paul and John and the Beatles and the times and you know, their fans, everything. So that's my job, is to get my wife to go, okay, all right, I get it.
She's on board. And you've done it.
Yes.
You've done it. You've convinced the boss.
Indeed, I guess. She's my greatest critic in that sense, where she'd be like, you're doing what? So, you know, and I had that, because when I wrote the Destroyer book, a lot of my music journalist friends were like, what? I said, well, come on. There's 10 books about Pet Sounds. There's 50 books about Sgt. Right. Pepper's. I mean, can right. we, you know, I know it's not rumors, but I would always get into these arguments with other music journalists, especially in college. Best rock albums of the 70s, and nobody ever brought a Kiss album up. So I said, right. I love Destroyer, and I kept arguing. I said, you know what? I'm going to write about this thing. Yes.
Right. And, you know, you were right. I was watched one of your interviews years ago. I think it was on Kiss My Wax or something like that. And you call Kiss is an American icon, and you're right. You know, I did see them again last year, last August, during the end of this, at this so-called end of the road tour, you know, and it just didn't have the same, because I saw them in 96 with the original reunion
tour. Yeah, me too. Yeah,
you know, and I saw them in Tiger Stadium because I used to live in Michigan.
Oh, so and you had the first show.
Yes, absolutely. Nice. Absolutely. And just a mind-blowing experience. But it just lacked that magic this time around. But I still love the band. But, you know, what are you going to do? What do you got next? I mean, can you give us a little hint of what you got going next? Or is that a secret?
I it's not that it's a secret. It's just that until my publisher gives me the okay, there's a lot of people I have to contact, rights.
Music
and everything
related?
Like it is.
Okay.
It'll be for Backbeat, and it'll be another music-related book. And, you know, I really wanted... I was fortunate. I wrote this book because Adam is a, you know, he's a songwriter and he's a singer and he's a brilliant and a wonderful guy and a really good friend now, but he's not a writer. So his discipline is not where I wanted, you know, like where I would be, because he's got a million things going on and he was writing new music. Their newest record, The Butter Miracle, is fantastic. So he was doing this and he was going on tour. So the idea was, we did these series of interviews for 6 months, every week, 3 hours, and we transcribed them, and I started putting them together as a history of his process as a musician and a songwriter, his childhood, all these his influences. But he said, oh, I'd like to see it first. So I thought, okay, it's about his life. He should approve it. And we got into a partnership agreement. But then he started adding things and writing. And I realized, this guy is a lit major from Cal, man. He knows what he's doing. And so we started to really write together, and I thought, this is great. But you know, he's not sitting around waiting to do the next chapter. So, to make a long story short, he's not working as quickly as I would like him to work. So I wrote another book, and now I'm going to write another book, which I haven't even told him yet, because I want to tell him, you know, that I'm going to busy myself while he's off being a rock star. So, so hopefully that book will eventually come out, because it's a really great insight into how creative people work.
Gotcha. All right, hold on 1 second. Andy, what do you tell us what you got going? I know your channel's growing, and you're gonna you got your new Dylan show too, right?
Yeah, dropped the Record Store Day review video yesterday on my channel, Andy's Music Vault, The Other Leg. And I've got a 2-part episode on Bob Dylan coming up, which by the time this show airs, I think will have already been out. So this is a few weeks away. That's my channel. It's a sub 2-leg channel, just for my little other interested in music outside of the Beatles and Paul McCartney. So stay tuned for stuff on that.
Oh, great. Very good. I'll be listening, man. That's cool. And if you guys want me on for anything to bullshit about any kind of, you know, music. By the way, I remember when I worked at Record World in 1985, I remember that Broad Street stand up right behind
me. There you go. That's awesome.
There you go.
Regards to Broad Street.
To Broad Street. There you go. For us, you can find us at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Two Legs Podcast. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, everybody, for subscribing to our YouTube channel. As you all know, we passed the 1,000 subscriber goal. Very grateful for you guys for coming in and supporting us as a show and as an audio platform as well. And really, please help support these books. I'm a big physical media junkie. I do not want e-books. I don't care. I want my shelves full of Beatle books.
We do have an e-book, though. There will be an
okay.
E-book.
Well, fine. If you want to get that, get it. But anyways, the point is, please help support these books, and they really are important. And you know, again, take a sad song, the emotional currency of Hey Jude. There'll be a lookout. It'll be out in May 15th, was it?
Yes. And thank you, guys. I know you guys got a PDF version. Thank you for ordering it. and you know, supporting and for giving me some time. This was a blast, seriously, man. You guys do a great job. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks. So so for Andy, for James, I'm Tom. As always, everybody out there, have a beautiful day. Or no, have a great day and a beautiful night.
There you go.
Take care.